64 in Danville, 64 in Decatur, and 67 degrees on Friends Plaza in Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
For more than a decade, Washington University anthropologist Cricket Sands and Lincoln Park Zoo research conservationist David Morgan have lived and worked in a remote stretch of forest in Africa's Congo Basin, studying chimpanzees and gorillas. Together with local Congolese, they founded the Gugulo Triangle Ape Project. Its mission is to study and protect great apes and their habitat. Sands and Morgan spoke with reporter Veronique LaCapra.
The Gugulo Triangle Ape Project was set up to study the chimpanzees and gorillas in a unique area where there hadn't been any human presence for a long time, but it was gazetted for logging. And so David and I set forth to get to know all the chimpanzees and the gorillas and their behavior in hopes of protecting the area. And we were very fortunate after 13 years to have achieved that goal when the area was annexed to the Nwabali-Ndoki National Park in January of this last year.
People may not be familiar with African geography. Can you explain a little bit where this region is? It's part of the Congo Basin. How do you get there and where is it?
The Republic of Congo is located in equatorial Africa and Central Africa. It's actually bordered by Gabon and Cameroon and the Democratic Republic of Congo. You would fly from St. Louis to Paris and then from Paris down into the capital of Brazzaville. From Brazzaville, we take a domestic flight to a regional capital of Weso, which is about 20-some thousand people, I believe. We then take a dugout canoe, which is a big hollowed-out tree, about 6 hours up the Songa River. We spend the night in the park headquarters. We then take a truck ride for an hour on a logging road. Another dugout canoe. This time you can just barely fit your hips in it, and you paddle yourselves down a river. And then we hike for 6 hours into one of the most pristine and remote field sites in the world.
What's it like to live in such a remote area doing your research? I mean, what do you have to bring with you? How do you live? Is there anybody else there with you?
We have a team of about 10 trackers and several field assistants from Congo. We do camping. We have a base camp, so we live in tents. Very rustic, as Cricket likes to call it, and no communications, basically, except for satellite telephones. No email contact. And we love it. It's very remote, and in that case, it's very special. There aren't many places like that left, even in Central Africa in the Congo Basin.
How long do you typically stay when you go there?
When we first started, we would go for 11 months of the year and just come back for 1 month. We did that for about 8 years, and now I'm teaching at Washington University, so I'm here in the spring and the fall and go over the summer for about four-month stints. But David will spend between 6 to 8 months of the year there.
Well, so you were talking about how hard it is to get there, so you must be carrying a whole lot of stuff to be able to stay there for months at a time.
Yeah, we bring our computers, lots of backpacks. We go in with teams of maybe 25 to 30 porters at a time.
We typically have about 500 pounds of luggage coming from the States.
You've chosen what many people would consider a pretty unusual life path, if I can put it that way. What made you want to do this kind of work?
Since I can remember, I wanted to be out in the forest studying chimpanzees. I can remember the first time I saw a chimpanzee in a zoo, and I spent my lifetime trying to get to that point to find a place. And fortunately, we did find an area where chimpanzees had never even seen humans before. And I remember when I was young, people saying chimps are endangered, they're declining. And so this is really a great opportunity.
When I was in university, I worked at a facility where chimpanzees knew American Sign Language. And so I volunteered there. I was fluent in sign language from when I was a child and had a neighbor that was deaf and asked a chimpanzee a question and she answered and looked into her eyes and thought, I could definitely study these individuals for a lifetime. They're just fascinating.
Has there ever been a time when you felt like this is just too hard? I can't do this anymore?
No, I think for us, every day is extraordinary when we're out in the forest. It's hard fundraising and doing the science and managing teams, but we feel very fortunate.
There are some days when you get charged by an elephant and you think, boy, my goodness, what am I doing out here? But it's also very exhilarating and exciting, and it is every day is filled with adventure, and you look forward to getting up and wondering what you'll see that day.
Those were primatologists Cricket Sands and David Morgan speaking with reporter Veronique LaCapra. Winemaking isn't just for the countryside, at least not in France. There's an urban vineyard located in the heart of the French capital. In the 1920s, local artists planted grapevines to prevent a developer from wiping out the block. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has the story.
Every year for a week in October, residents from the Paris neighborhood of Montmartre pour into the streets to celebrate their grape harvest, known as the Fête des Vendanges. There is a costume parade, street performances, concerts, and giant picnics, all in honor of a small patch of land on a slope surrounded by houses with mansard roofs, a leafy plot the size of a city block whose dark purple Gamay and Pinot Noir grapes produce 1,000 bottles of red wine a year. The gates of Montmartre's vineyard, known as Clos Montmartre, are open for visitors in October. Head winemaker Francis Gourdin is giving a tour.
Urban vineyards like this one, and also famous ones in places like Barcelona or Cape Town, are a sort of conservatory of a city's culture and history.
The vineyard was born in the 1920s, Gourdin tells his listeners, when a group of well-known artists living here wanted to block a real estate project. So they planted grapevines. And under French law, nothing can be built on a vineyard. The first harvest came in 1933. Clos Montmartre is not a great wine, says Gourdin, but it's a respectable one. Amongst Gourdin's group this morning are visitors from as far away as Norway and Mexico, and Parisians like Arthur Assadourian.
I know many places in Paris, but Montmartre is unique because of the life which was here in the past. I mean, the painters, the atmosphere, and this atmosphere that existed in the past. I can find it, for instance, in this vineyard. It's very special.
Vineyards covered much of this hilly part of Paris up until the 18th century. They diminished with industrialization and were completely wiped out in the late 1800s by the phylloxera epidemic. Today, Montmartre, like the rest of France, is replanted with American vine stock. After Montmartre's grapes are harvested, they're brought down to the basement of the town hall here in the 18th arrondissement, where they're pressed, fermented, and bottled.
You can smell the wine.
Town hall employee Olivia Bissiau explains that this is the only government office in Paris to make wine. The half bottles, which are considered collector's items, sell for $50 each, she says, and all the proceeds go to charity. Children are always a part of the Montmartre Fête des Vendanges. And every October, the streets of Montmartre become an open-air market with gastronomic specialties from every corner of France. And bien sûr, everything on the menu marries well with a bottle of Montmartre Rouge. Damien Compomas is selling his cheese and sausage from the French Alps.
And this is sausage from Savoie. You want to try sausage?
This crowd sings nostalgic songs as the 79th Vendange Festival winds to a close. The next time you visit Paris, be sure to head up to Montmartre for a good time and a glass of fine city wine. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL. And by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, and pet foods. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 16th of October, 2012. It's the birthday of Eugene O'Neill, born in New York City in a hotel room on Broadway, 1888. His father, a famous actor, O'Neill spent much of his childhood in hotels, on trains, going with his father on tours. It was when he was 24, he fell sick with tuberculosis, spent 6 months in a sanatorium, and while there he started to read classic playwrights and start to write plays himself. He wrote 11 one-act plays. In just a few years, they were put on in Provincetown, Massachusetts, by the Provincetown Players. 1920, his play Beyond the Horizon was a big success on Broadway. Anna Christie in 1922, Strange Interlude in 1928. It's the birthday of Noah Webster, born in Hartford, Connecticut, 1758, who wrote the first American dictionary, standardizing the spelling and pronunciation of the American language. And it's the birthday of the man who said, "We are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars," Oscar Wilde, Dublin, 1854. When he was 27, he was invited to go on a lecture tour of North America, invited by the producer of Gilbert and Sullivan's new comic opera, Patience, a work which made fun of the aesthetic movement, the art for art's sake movement. The producer wasn't sure if people around America would be familiar with the thing that the opera was satirizing, and so to make it clear, they had Oscar Wilde come on tour in his purple coat to Topeka, Boston, Des Moines, Houston, St. Paul, San Francisco, and dozens of other cities. Oscar Wilde was married. He had two children. But in 1891, when he fell in love with a 22-year-old Lord Alfred Douglas Ross, he began the most productive period of his literary life. He wrote The Picture of Dorian Gray, his only novel, the year he met Alfred, wrote the play A Woman of No Importance, and The Importance of Being Earnest, wrote the first draft in just 21 days. Here's a poem for today by Stanley Plumley, a poem with an Italian term in it, Salotto Città, living city, the poem entitled Autumnal. Not long before she died, my mother told me that her one regret was never to have traveled, and that since she had just read about it, or somewhere that reminded her from some time, Venice was the place she would have gone to, and might still, in her haunting of the afterlife. She had already questioned God in heaven and the heavy Bible verses she was taught, and now saw death as her last chance to live, her last chance to spend the green gold leaf pressed into books each October on her birthday. She wept. She understood the innocence of dying. And here she was, propped up against her pillow the way she finally would be in her coffin, with her eyeglasses held between the light and open page. She wanted me to hear the article that said that Venice would be filled like all Italy that season, and that Venice in particular was vulnerable and small, weighted with the souls of travelers, and that in the Grand Canal rivers of dark waters moved. Would there be space? It said, Salotto Città.